Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm at BBC New Broadcasting House and joined by Sarah Sands, the editor of the Today programme. Sarah was editor at the Sunday Telegraph and then the Evening Standard before joining what the controller of Radio 4 has described as the biggest hitting news programme of them all and has been tasked with introducing fresh ideas to the show. Sarah, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, nice, easy, open question to start with. Editing the programme that literally sets the nation's agenda every morning, I mean, that must be the best job in journalism.
It is. Maybe the best job in the world, actually. It's if you want to be a journalist, you want a sense of being at the centre of events and to be at the actual sort of nerve centre in the way Today programme is. Is just hugely interesting. And mostly, you know, I think journalists are bad at being bored. You know, you will never be bored at the Today programme. And actually just looking at that green room, it's not just that it's like a sort of mini Davos, it's much more interesting than that because it's the juxtapositions of people making policy at the sharp end of that policy. The other day we had a couple of brain scientists, one who had done some terrific work on dementia, and next to and who was Belgian, and next to him it was a discussion about immigration, and he sat there very sort of politely, and then afterwards said, "But that's me you're talking about," you know, and that's the sort of, so it's almost that sort of the conversation that you have outside the studio, where you see issues being played out in this extraordinary way, and knowing that just sets the agenda for the day. You know, I go into a news meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning. Knowing we're done, and that it's now sort of the rollout of that news agenda. So it couldn't be more interesting.
So I imagine, like me, you must have listened to the Today programme for decades. It must be a complete change now to be the editor. Did you have a sense of just what a big task you had ahead of you, and how important the job was as you went into it?
Yes, I never doubted that. You know, that the size of this institution. I mean, it's. I was very happy doing the job that I was doing before. I was editing a newspaper. I knew how to do that. I've been in newspapers all my life. But when this came up, I just, well, you can't turn down the Today programme. So there was a sort of great sense of sort of privilege and responsibility. I'm still a listener, and in a way, that's the crucial thing. You know, when I first started, and everyone had these very, very strong views, were saying, you know, you're like this, and you're doing this wrong, and this, but, you know, and so on. And in the end, I thought, well, look, do you want to come and do this job? And then thought, no, that's the point of it, that everyone owns this show. It really is the programme that everyone's getting up to. So just the sheer sort of intimacy of that. And the importance of it, you know, not just in national life, but in people, in personal lives. And so you always have to bear that in mind. So I'm the editor, but I'm also a listener, you know, like everybody else.
And what was top of your to-do list as you came in?
I think it's a very, very good programme. So the main thing is to build on those strengths. I guess if you define it, it sets the agenda and you hold power to account. So those are the two first principles which you have to stick to. I think beyond that, it was to maybe open it up a bit to a sense that there was this sort of great world, and that, you know, one thing that was very exciting to me coming into the BBC is the resources we have around the world. You know, that you really can find people everywhere. In fact, we had a Vatican correspondent on today. Imagine, you know.
You wouldn't have had one of them at the Standard.
We didn't have one of those at the Standard. So just to sort of make use of that, and then to see that if you are, by the end of the programme, it's a 3-hour programme, it's a long programme, but I sort of think at the end of it, you should be about as well informed as you could possibly be, and that we will bring you everything you need to know and some of the things that you didn't know that you needed to know, perhaps, so that you can have that range. So I guess it was also coming from a newspaper. I tend to think a bit in the way of newspaper that you need a mix of subjects. So I guess in that way it was to maybe slightly broaden the subjects we're doing and broaden the and just a slightly bigger canvas because we can, you know, so you can get people from all over the world, you can get people in Britain, and that as I say, in the end, you've reflected the world as it is, and the world as it could and will be. So also the world of the imagination, you know, that in a newspaper, arts is part of what you do. It's part of people's lives. It's quite odd to, you know, some of the criticism when I first started, people saying, but you're doing stuff in arts. And I said, do you never talk about art? Isn't civilization, you know, made up of arts as well as politics? And
there's a world out there beyond Westminster.
Yes, there is. And I guess that's another thing, that, yes, people's lives aren't entirely dictated by the government. You'd be surprised, you know, how people can get by sometimes. So it's so actually just sending reporters out, not just across the world, but domestically, you know. So actually one of the earlier things, one of the first things, you know, looking ahead at Brexit, you know, was to say, but what about fish? You know, it starts with fish and it's going to continue to be about fish. So actually going out in that way and sort of bringing back. So what I love is when I think that's something I really didn't know and I don't think other people knew. So that it should be a programme that teaches in the best sense, I think.
And now you've been in post for some time. What aspects of the job are what you thought they would be? And what aspects of the job have surprised you? Is there anything that's raised an eyebrow where you that was genuinely unexpected? Or is it all new?
Well, it's new. I mean, the jeopardy of it is new to me. You know, on a newspaper, there is a little bit of a time lag, you know, that you can, you know, you can check things, you can polish things. In radio, it's all it has to, you know, the briefing is done, you know, before. There's no time to correct. Once you're on air, that's it, you know. And so we have had moments of sort of pure jeopardy. We had, I remember Gilbert and George coming on, who were exhibiting in Belfast, and just launched this final sort of tirade as we were coming up to 9 o'clock on Presbyterian, the Presbyterian critics, and their last word was evil, and then the pips went, you know, and you sort of just wiped
ending.
Your brow. So that sense that it's both tremendously professional, so that was something that really impressed me, that the team behind it is so professional. Honestly, they're like Bletchley, you know, they... everything is thought through, that the sense of this running order that all the way through the day you're sort of improving and working on and perfecting, so that you hope at the end, you know, it's the best you can possibly be. So it's just that pursuit of excellence. And then once you're on air, you have to just think, hope for the best, you know, it's the best we can do, and you can't control every, you know, you hope that things are going to come to work to plan, and you can intervene a little bit, and you can still carry on trying to update and improve the programme, you know, because you still got time because of that 3 hours for the last bit, but still that the sense of sort of adrenaline that it's live, I suppose that's still the thing that I have to get used to.
Is it a bit like being a football manager, you know, when they're stood at the side of the pitch during the game, that you're not one of the players, but it's they're executing your strategy, and you kind of have all the highs and lows, even though you stood at the side, and you can intervene, but you're not actually on the pitch?
I suppose it's, I think they're a bit more reliable than the football, you know, it's not so unpredictable in performance, I think, that you, I guess we're doing a bit more sort of planning, because it just helps you. I think that was one thing I guess I brought to the programme, that was a little bit hand to mouth. And I just thought that if you're going to get some of the people on that you want, who don't have to be on, you know, there are those that just know that they have to be on the programme. So that's your politicians and so on. Sometimes getting more women onto the programme and so on is you just have to work a bit harder, because women are more reluctant to speak and in public, and the time's not great for them, a lot of them. So then that sense of actually trying to make it more sort of convenient, or planning, a bit more planning in advance. So I think I know what's going to happen during the programme. So I think there's a greater sense, certainly greater sense of predictability, but you're right, in the end, you know, you're not on the pitch, you know. I look, in fact, it was interesting, something John Humphrey said to me was, he said, oh, you don't come into the studio, you know, you stay in the gallery, you know, why is that? And I said, because that's, you know, that's you, this is my domain, that's
the
yours,
theater of
you
war.
Know? And exactly, and so and that's why, you know, I do respect those presenters very much, because once they're in, once they're in the studio, it's, you know, it's just them, and you know, there's nothing between them and the audience, and so that is quite a, you know, high wire act. So again, you just need a terrific degree of professionalism, actually, is what gets you through.
You are right though, because even now I think the programme does sound less male, if I can put it like that. How else would you describe the changes that you've made so far in terms of the outcomes?
I'm pleased when people say that that they wake up and feel it's been a great window onto the world. You know, that's what I like, that it, you feel breadth and range and boldness, I guess. That there's a and that we're trying to approach some stories in maybe a more inquiring way. So that, of course, as I say, at heart, you are holding power to account. That's what you're doing. And sometimes, if power turns out to be slippery, you know, you have to go hard on that. On other things, you know, on, we're doing quite a lot more science stories, for instance. And in that case, you really want to find out. You know, you're trying to help the listener. You're on a journey with the listener on this one. So that, so I think I can see or hear more variety of styles in the way that the interviews go. And that there's also, which is the reason I love this running order, you know, is that you can do everything. So you can do hard news, you can do analysis, you can do humour, you can do charm. You know, there was one programme, I know that someone messaged to say, I can't believe, you know, you've just done North Korea and then gone into Winnie the Pooh. And I went, yes, that's the Today
Light
program.
Light and shade. Exactly. Yeah, that's a great program.
So I think it's, you know, that people's lives should be, you know, vivid and varied. And that's, you know, that's what you're giving them.
Do you think that the program has become slightly less of that kind of gladiatorial combat where John will, you know, attack someone, rightly so, hold them to account, but it seems to be slightly more of a, gone to more of a Socratic dialogue, an exploratory type of thing, which for me is more constructive. I mean, for many years, that's one of my biggest frustrations, is that, and it's not to criticise the programme, actually, it's more the ministers, that they're just a bit slippery, and you end up after 10 minutes of trying to catch each other out on technicalities, neither party's none the wiser.
It's such an interesting question about how do you get, basically, it's pursuit of truth. So what's your course for that? And that sometimes I think you can, there's just a sort of frustration or indignation that someone just isn't answering the question. And there's a slight theatre to the, I'm going to just ask that again, you know. So I think sometimes that works. I've really sort of watched now, I've come to know some of the sort of public figures because they obviously come in quite often, and knowing when I can see them sort of seizing up, you know, and I know that when the answer is going to become a predictable one because they've shut down, basically. So it's how do you keep them in play, you know, so that it does become, so that you really are trying to get to the truth, and you do get to the truth. And sometimes that's, you know, policy sort of question. I mean, actually, the Prime Minister is an interesting one. And I think, you know, sometimes I've seen it be more effective when you're asking her about the thinking behind her decisions, or there's a way of sort of drawing her out. I know that she said of in general, you know, she doesn't like mansplaining. And I think that there's a certain style, you know, that can actually just shut people down. So I think it's a constant work in progress, and I'm really, really interested. But I think that as long as we're clear about the purpose, you know, we're not there just to make ourselves look clever. We're not there to sort of humiliate. We're there to find out the truth. So as I say, you have to employ, you know, many different tools. And actually, John Humphreys is a really interesting example, who I think has a more very varied, actually, interviewing style. You know, he's associated with gladiatorial, but you see him with a you know, with someone who's sort of vulnerable, or you know, in the end, he's always on the side of the, it's sort of us, you know, the small person, us against power. So he will always side with you on that.
He's a great interviewer. I've known John for quite a few years, actually. And in fact, he's done this podcast. He's sat in that very chair. Yeah. And I agree with you.
He's a master.
There's a reason why he's one of the lead presenters and has been for so many years. So where do you want to take the show over the next year or two?
It's a process of just sort of constant improvement. I always just want it to be better. You know, at the end of it, I think, oh, we did that. When I do this little post-mortem notes and say, you know, we did this well, this didn't work so well, you know, and then I always think tomorrow we can be better, you know. And sometimes it's whether you can, so what makes you better? And it may be that you've got, you know, just some really, really interesting sort of speakers. It may be that you've got to grips with a subject, which I'm trying to do a bit more. Again, because we have the luxury of time, Of, for instance, today we did a broadcast, a co-present from Gibraltar, and that meant that you could just approach the subject with a bit more depth and explanation and get a greater cast on it. So I can think, oh, we did that subject well, we did that subject really well. And I think, therefore, it's sort of drawing in, so I hope that our own audience are happy, and then it's trying to draw in, you know, ever greater, the world domination is pretty much the aim, I think. Yeah. So for instance, we're doing more outside broadcast from universities and so on. So you're trying to get a greater cast of sort of characters and voices and views. I think that's the big thing, that are we representing enough people? You know, so that's always the quest of greater diversity, basically.
Is it ever any trouble to get guests on the show? Because like you said, the politicians have to come on, but other people don't necessarily have to unless they've got a book to promote or whatever. And there is a little bit now of people seem to be attacked from all sides. I mean, you do feel a tiny bit sorry for politicians coming on the show because they're going to have half the audience attack them on Twitter or whatever they say. You can understand why they're defensive sometimes.
Yeah, I think they feel better on the Today programme than social media, oddly. You know, before it was seen as sort of the bar, you know, so it was very, very daunting. And some people, I know, actually, there's a Tory politician, a female Tory politician I know, who's tremendously confident, who does a strategy on women for the Tories. So it's about encouraging women to be more confident, encouraging women into public life. She will not come on the programme. She just says, I'm sorry, too daunting. Can't do it. Sorry, too daunting. And I think, but you're the one that's meant to be encouraging women. So I think that there's a bit of that. But actually, I think more and more, when you see how difficult it is to get your message across, just to sort of speak thoughtfully on social media, because you know, people because of the degree of volatility and that people can misinterpret you and so on, that there's something about the sort of calm, rational forum of the Today programme that even if the questions are tough, they're rational and you know why, and they're logical, you know why they're being asked and so on. So actually, I think it becomes more and more attractive in the kind of environment. I think, you know, the two absolutely greatest qualities now for journalism as sort of trust and authority, and actually those are the qualities that are the basis foundation for the Today programme.
In my professional life, I'm a media advisor to chief executives all around the world. And we do a bit of media training, and I asked John in this podcast, you know, what media training would you give, what tips would you give a CEO that's about to be grilled by you? And he said, well, it's very easy, tell him not to come on. Don't do it. I thought that was quite
useful. I wouldn't say that. I'd say, you know, do come on, just to be authentic is probably the advice, you know, that so and you know, to tell the truth. It tends to go wrong, you know, when you know you're on sort of thin ice and you're and so you start to sort of flannel or you start to use slogans or whatever, you know, just be truthful. People respect that, you know. People will allow you to make mistakes, people will allow you to be human. But be authentic, I think. And actually, again, on business, which is a real strength of the Today programme, I think, because not just the timing, but it's a programme that clearly takes business seriously. So you're not starting. We have Jeremy Paxman, picture.
Yes,
Jeremy,
we're in a
Paxman,
room with Jeremy
room,
Paxman on the,
looking
on the
at
door.
Us. We're looking tremendously bored and cynical. That's not our, you know, that's not our starting point. And business, I find incredibly interesting at the moment, actually, in the light of Brexit and so on, that what kind of business leadership are we going to see in these times? And another thing, perhaps from coming outside the BBC, so being aware, so being not quite so government focused, you know, I'm used to seeing businesses playing a big part, you know, part in people's lives, you know. That's the jobs. And so so I think that I would say absolutely sort of step up, you know, we'll be fair. And you can and just imagine how important a forum that is, you know. So if you do want to think about something important. And actually, I've spent quite a bit of time with business CEOs who are trying to think in a big picture way, you know, at the moment, that one thing that has that Brexit's made everyone think about is what sort of country we're going to be. And so thinking long term, perhaps rather than sort of short term, and that thinking about the what's the changes that are coming, automation and so on, the changes that's going to make to the workplace. So there's some really, really sort of big themes that business particularly is going to be dealing with, and is perhaps in a better position sometimes than government to deal with them. just has just, you know, the politics can sometimes constrain you. So actually, this is exactly the time when you should be speaking. And if you're going to speak on big themes and big ideas in a way that you and you want to be listened to, then obviously come on the Today programme.
Well, and you mentioned there about the increased focus on business. And I think what that's one of the things that you brought as a kind of non-BBC lifer, someone who's had a career outside of the BBC. You know, when I read that you'd been appointed, I thought it was a stroke of genius because, you know, you are different from all, a lot of the other Today programme editors, your predecessors. They've been largely male. I mean, you're the only second woman to edit the programme. They're kind of BBC lifers. You know, I know quite a few of them. They're nice guys. But there is a kind of Today programme editor mould. And I feel terrible saying that, but you don't fit that.
No, so I hope that's about. I know, yeah, sort of one of the distinguished former editors yes. rather took
yes,
exception
to that. Yes,
I'll
have to backtrack hastily in the but, rest of his podcast.
Yes, all that very much is a disadvantage. It was interesting, actually, I was discussing this with, it was an historian, David Cannadine, of saying that I'm interested how government-focused, you know, a lot of the journalism is. And he said, well, of course, that's of course, because that's the BBC, and that so you will have a slightly obsessive, paranoid relationship with government, because in the end, at the back of your mind, you're thinking paymaster, you know. And so, and because I don't have, you know, I don't have that. So I think those some of those questions of how are we going to pay for this is one, and that sometimes could be asked more, I think, in journalism, which is again another good reason actually to have a sense of how the commercial world works and to do a bit more business journalism, and the other again to sort of see life beyond
government.
Yeah, you know, because you just have to think that we are there to reflect how the world is and how people. So I'm always really really interested in the stories that give you a little sort of snapshot of how people are leading their lives, you know. And often those come out of business. We were talking about the success of this firm, WeWork, the dentist thinking. So, you know, just imagine how offices have changed and people's expectations and working hours have changed and so on. You know, all these are sort of really big, interesting themes which don't quite fit into the government funding kind of question. So we just have to be a bit more expansive in the way that we think and address journalism, I think. Otherwise, you could get left behind.
And the breakfast media experience, whether it be kind of television or radio, is one of the few things now that people don't really time shift. So I watch everything on Netflix or iPlayer. I don't care when something starts at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday because I can watch it at 10:15 on Thursday. But you wouldn't really time shift the Today programme. It's something that's live and immediate. You stick the radio on when you're getting ready to go to work, and then you listen to it for half an hour. So there's something there that you don't have that opportunity to go again. It is literally of the moment.
You're absolutely right, and I think that is its sort of strength. That, and I've noticed people who there was some research early in the year. I think it was by Edelman, which was a worry about professionals consuming less news. You know, that suddenly and so they seem to say they listen to the Today programme. You know, beginning of the day, they're on it. They need to, you know, they get up, they want to know what's going on. They need to be well informed. And then they go off and say, there was this big question about, so what happens to them? You know, why aren't they watching the news? No one, because they've got lives, you know, doing things, you know, thank heavens, because otherwise. But that sense of that's the start of your day. And it's so intimately woven into people's days. I mean, it's basically it's time checks, isn't it? You know, and you measure, you can measure. So I'm always interested in what people's routines when they're listening to Today. And the bit, you know, you're in a shower and you catch something, and think, did they really say that? You know, and yes. So those moments that you have sort of throughout it. So I do think that's what gives it its real sort of pace. And actually, that's very much in its origins, that the first, I think, female editor right at the beginning had, so the direction for the presenters was vigorous and cheerful. And I always say that still there, you know, just remember, I'm vigorous and cheerful. So there has to be a sort of pace to it. There has to be a sense of getting go. You know, so when it doesn't work, as if it feels too slow or off the pace, you know, it just has to feel that it's happening now, as you say.
And I think, like a lot of listeners, I know the presenters' voices very well in terms of what I can opt in and opt out of. Because, like, I understand you have to have sport on there, but I consider all sport to be a waste of time. and that's my personal view. So when I'm in the shower, if I can hear Rob Bonnet speaking, he's a great broadcaster and a great journalist, but I'm not interested in any sport, so I can kind of slightly tune out. But then when it comes back to business or whatever it is, you can tune in. So for me, it's sport and thought for the day, but other than that, it's the whole thing. And I know from talking to editors past that you, because lots of people are trying to drop Thought for the Day, but you have it's you actually opt out of the programme for Thought for the Day. That's not under your editorial control, is it?
Well, there are bits of the programme, yes, that are so the bulletins have come from a different department. Thought for the Day isn't mine. I mean, my view of Thought for the Day is that the idea of it belongs on Today, as it turns out, because if not, you know, when I first heard that I didn't control Thought for the Day, and I start, well, shall I give it to someone else? Would Newsnight like to have it? Yeah, exactly. Since it has nothing to do with
and then you realise you've no choice.
And then realise, no, it's there. And then you think, well, it's there for a reason, as everything is in the Today programme. So when you go back, and of course, when it started, I mean, it was, you know, it used to have to be signed off by the Director General. It was, you know, something that's... So then you think, oh, it's because it's this institution. So, of course, you know, the church is important, you know, to us because it's one of the great institutions and we represent the great institutions. I mean, we're kind of one of them, but also, you know, we represent British life. And so so the church is part of that. So then I became really interested in it. And so do think a lot of the Thought for the Days, you know, are marvellous. So it's actually I've also tried to bring religion in to other parts of the programme. So we did, for instance, a piece on the persecution of the Coptic Christians with Frank Gardner, and that was a really so I think that was sort of quite a newsy piece because they there had been this sort of violence in Cairo, so it was or just outside, so it was it worked on news terms. It told you something you didn't know, which is always one of those sort of criteria, and then you went to Thought for the Day, which was about forgiveness, which is the Coptic's special thing. And so actually it felt rather sort of beautifully integrated. So I'm now thinking about actually how you can do religion in a Today way, you know, so that the whole thing feels more integrated. So I think with all these things, you know, business used to be pretty separate. And I think now thinking, no, it really is, it's not something we walk away from. It's absolutely part of the programme. It's incredibly important. So we're more joined up actually than.
It's interesting when you talk about opt-outs, because this is a very technical media geek question, yeah. But like at the top of the hour when John Humphrey says the BBC News is read by Rory Morrison,
yeah.
That's actually an opt-out to BBC News,
yes.
Whereas I think, well, the Today programme's BBC News, and yet it's not, it's a separate thing, isn't it? How does that work?
Well, that seemed odd to me, yeah. Yes, that and actually the newspaper and websites roundup, so when I first came and thought of course we should be doing websites as well, but it's you know, these are structural things, you know, so it sort of takes time. So on the sort of bulletins, that I mean, it does mean that, you know, you'll always have a spine of news, you know. It's interesting, you know, if people think oh, the news changed, the news hasn't changed actually, you know, it's exactly the same, that's your spine of news. And the Today bit, I guess, is the more, you know, it is news making. But it's that if it's that's the discussion and the analysis and your own reports and so on within it. So it doesn't, as all as the BBC, like the monarchy and everything, all the other great institutions, you know, because in some ways doesn't make sense, and yet it does. You know, it
shouldn't
works.
Work, but it does.
It shouldn't very, work, but it does. Well. Yes.
And do you get? I mean, what's the most thrilling part when it's on air? Because, you know, when it goes to the 8:10 main interview, even I, as a listener, if the interviewee says something incredibly eyebrow raising, I think, right, well, that's gonna be leading the 10:00 news tonight. Do you get a thrill as an editor that's you setting the agenda for the day?
Yes, when you hear the quote, that you think, oh yes, that's it. So I guess those, and you are a bit more braced for the 8:10. And then there's that very nice, the very dangerous bit is the last 10 minutes when you start to relax.
Yeah, when everyone's jovial. Yeah,
exactly. So nearly there is a nice discussion going on. And of course, that's where...
someone will say something.
That's where, yeah, we'll all be undone. That'll be what gets me fired in the end.
So what's a typical day like for you?
Well, I'm here just before 6. So there for the... obviously they to see the programme through, and then once the programme's over, there's a, you know, bit of discussion and post-mortem on it, then you're straight on to the next programme. So we work on that through the day. I try and see people so you're sort of collecting a sense of what's going on and stories, and perhaps go to Westminster and so on, and then we have a 4:15 meeting. So there's an 11:30 meeting, which is, so that's the foundations of the next day's programme. 4:15, you hope you're in a better state There's quite an elaborate handover between the day desk and the night desk after 8:30, and then after the news at 10, I'll go through the final order with the night editor.
So it's full on then. So a lot of
so
hours.
So it's all because you're always because it is always this work in progress. That's what you have to remember about it. And this and the team work so hard. That night shift is 14 hours, and you are doing straight into the programme. So
I think the coffee machine will be hammered overnight, won't it?
Yeah. So it really is. It's a team. I've never met a team quite so professional as this one.
And how often does this happen, where you'll kind of intricately plan the day during the day, then you'll come in at 6 o'clock and it's all been thrown out of the window because something's happened? What's the percentage of, like, if you go to sleep with 100% of the program planned, what percentage of those plans will remain by the time you wake up?
Yeah, it depends. I would say rarely. You know, I'm trying to think. From last year, the terrorism event, there's Grenfell and so on. So those things happened at night, Manchester. So maybe five times a year there'll be something, an election or something that's overnight that means everything's fresh in the morning. Actually, the election, I think we did, where we did 4 hours, actually. We did an extended programme. So that's all just of the moment. Usually, I would hope, 80% of it is in place, because I think that's, you want the energy of what's new, but you want quality. And on the whole, quality tends to come by, as with all things, if you've spent time on it. So normally it's just the running order may change, something may fall through, so that you have a few holes, or as we call them, broadcasting opportunities. So it's variable, but on the whole, I would say, as I say, about 80%, I would say, remains.
It's largely intact then, by the time
largely intact, right. Yeah.
That's part of the thrill,
and sometimes, actually, if you've done a special programme, and then, that's goes against everything of you thinking, make news not happen, because, you've got this sort of perfect, but actually, news is still always the most exciting thing, so it trumps everything else.
It's a strange question to ask, really, because we're almost in a kind of what I would call a post-W1A atmosphere now at the BBC, where having W1A been to air, the stuff that happens in the real BBC is almost outdoes it, really. And I remember memorably a couple of weeks ago, Carrie Gracie was presenting the programme, where a large part of the programme was about her, where she had to sit, on the side, having been discussed and not able to comment. And rightly so, but there was an element of, not farce is the wrong word, but it was just unusual. What was your view there as the editor? Were you frustrated that the very person being spoken about couldn't speak?
Well, it was bizarre, but I think that's back to this idea that it may look bonkers, but it works. So you just had to go back to first principles, and the first principles for the BBC, trust and impartiality. So impartiality becomes important. So it is odd, yes, you're the subject of the story, but
she
can't
interview someone on her own pay.
She can't interview herself on her own pay, obviously. And there was, so we did say, so what if John interviews her and so on, but actually, so she could have come on. So the discussion was she could have come on the programme to talk about it. It's just but she was a presenter. She was down to be a presenter that day. I thought she was great.
She's and, a great journalist and a great
she's
presenter.
She's a great journalist and great presenter. So I didn't want to stand her down. She didn't want to stand down. And I didn't see why I should stand her down. But it just created this problem. So the only way to get round it was that she could present, but she couldn't comment on it. And then once she stopped being a presenter, I did try and get her back actually to do an interview later in the week. But I think by then, she was exhausted.
Well, I've said this a few times, but it is actually a tribute to the BBC's integrity. Yeah. That one of the best, most impartial organisations to cover the BBC's troubles is the BBC. They report on that. I mean, you might say that they have a gift for kicking themselves a lot, but actually it's that they want to make sure that because of the licence fee that they have to cover their own troubles without fear or favour.
It's true. That the sense of being fair and impartial is absolutely engraved on the heart. So it is, I thought it was, again, I was pretty new to the BBC. And so on one hand, I just thought this is any other organisation, you would be fired. You know, I just, what's going on? But also thinking, isn't it magnificent? And actually, Carrie, at the end of that week, where, you know, she's torn into the BBC, you know, then tweeted, isn't the BBC great? You know, and I think I'm allowed to present the Today programme, isn't the BBC great? And I think it really, it did show, you know, that it's a unique and magnificent institution.
It seems to me that the BBC hasn't conspired against women deliberately. They've not set out to do them down, but it's certainly a PR disaster for them as well. And they seem to have got a few things wrong. Either, do you think they're doing enough to put it right in terms of the BBC women problem?
Well, I think, again, it's the standard to which you're held account, because now that all the other companies are starting to have to publish their pay disparities, you see much greater.
Yeah, they're worse, you know, absolutely.
Much worse. So I think partly it was just the BBC was first, you know, so it was first, and it's always scrutinised so much more than any.
Yeah, the BBC has enemies. Commercial broadcasters love to give you guys a kicking.
Of course. So I think that was, and I think the other thing, which is part of the, you know, much greater sort of revolution going on, I think, as far as women are concerned, is that sense of historical perspective. You know, if I've been around a long time, you know, so I'm used to knowing that there was a time when men dominated and they were paid a lot. Then pay came down, partly because the market sort of collapsed in news. And that was also a time where a lot of women were being recruited. So it was unlucky, you know, we came to the party late, I'm afraid. But I think I certainly don't see sort of conspiracy. I can see sort of complacency, you know, perhaps from, you know, the familiarity. So, and I think looking back, you know, an inflation of the market. But I think maybe that was because at the time it was the case. But now, you know, that was the first thing that when you say, oh, it'll be a poacher's charter, you know, look at the media landscape outside.
Do you think it would go a long way if the BBC appointed a female director general when Tony decides to stand aside?
A lot of women at the BBC.
We haven't had a female DG yet.
Not yet. Well, maybe.
Fran, yourself?
Look, I think I've pushed my luck already coming here with, you know, considered not quite qualified.
You'd reveal your plans to take over.
I'm not going to push my luck on this one. But there are some very, very good women. There are some very good men. You know, I mean, I'm a great believer in the best person for the job.
And does it help your job as editor, having come from a newspaper background?
I think there's a common sense of journalism. So I think although it's a different discipline, I think I understand the journalism. And I think one thing about the newspapers, you know, for good and for bad, perhaps because they've been less regulated and under less scrutiny, but there's a slightly more buccaneering quality. So you're a bit less risk averse and perhaps a bit more, you know, the fun of troublemaking, I guess. So that's the thing that you know, that news is disruptive, you know, and so I think that sense that not to be worried if you're in the middle of a sort of controversy. But I think, you know, what you learn from the BBC is to be responsible about that, not just do it for its own sake. And of course, you know, newspapers at their worst, you know, have done terrible criminal things.
You spent many successful years as editor of the Evening Standard. Can you read the Standard now as a normal punter, you know, on the train home, for example? Or is it a bit like, you know, if you remarry and you see your previous partner's remarried and you can't look at it? How does that feel when you're
I really enjoy it because, you know, I'm a commuter. And so I get the tube at Oxford Circus on the Central Line. And I love that, which actually, because you were in the office before at the Evening Standard, you know, you didn't... I tended not to... Well, I used to come out to see the vendor at the... Kensington High Street, who always made a special flourish of saying, you know, Evening Standard, I think, as I went out. So there was the joy of that. But no, I really enjoy reading it, and I like reading this. And I'm already muddling tongue readers, listeners. I still do what I've always done. There was when we used to look at the papers in the morning. You know, we used to just look for spelling mistakes, you know, see, and there's such a tremendous pleasure if someone had used a word wrongly, so, which of course doesn't matter now because it, you know, it's all about pronunciation, not about spelling. So I can't help but looking for, you know, sort of slightly wonky odd uses of fonts or sort of layouts or admiring headlines or something. So I still look at it in a slightly technical way.
Yeah, you're not a regular reader.
I'm not a totally
You're a regular reader who happens to be the ex-editor.
Exactly. Then.
I mean, yours was a slightly left-field appointment on the Today programme, if I can say that. But I think indeed, but George Osborne was an incredibly left-field appointment. I mean, my flabber was gasted.
Well, I remember actually when I was told it was him, and so people would ask, if you know, so who's in the frame? Who do you think it's going to be? And I went, well, I'm hearing it's George Osborne. And they go, yeah, but who's in the frame? Like, no, honestly, I'm hearing it's George Osborne. You know, couldn't get anyone to print it. So, but I think that in a way, as it, you know, going back to newspapers being places that are surprising. You know, that they are owned by private individuals. Who can do what they like, you know, that they, so that on the whole, so there's, and there is, that tends to be a slightly sort of buccaneering quality to them. So in a way, it was quite a sort of smart move, I think, of you wanted the paper to feel relevant and interesting. And certainly, you know, people read it for its politics now. In a you know, particularly attentive way.
Well, the owners can do what they like, as you say, they're private individuals, but so can the readers. I mean, you know, I unsubscribe from emails and stop reading newspapers and magazines if they become less relevant. And I think one of the things I wanted to ask you is about your time as editor at The Standard, because, I mean, everyone had written it off all those years ago. Going free was going to be the last throw of the dice, and it was the kind of conventional wisdom was that it was inevitably going to decline. And, of course, you've proved everyone wrong. I mean, it's an incredible success and more relevant now to Londoners than ever.
Well, I hope so. So I think, you know, really editing is this sort of contract of faith and trust that you have with your readers or listeners. So with the Evening Standard, you know, everyone said, the great thing is that it's free. So that's its secret. And I said, no, it's not the secret. The secret is that we have to make it good and free. You know, so people feel it's a gift, not just something that we kind of think, oh, we can put on any old rubbish because it's free. So treat it, so always behave as if it's paid for. That was the rule. So the sense of sort of professional pride, you know, even while there was some sort of commercial interest just saying, oh, do you have to, you know, it's too expensive to do comment and, you know, can you not do it more so cheaply? Just say, no, these things matter because it has to be a paper of influence and people have to think it's good. So actually, try to be good is, you know, is a pretty sort of simple is a pretty simple lesson, but I think it works. And so I think having once people realise that they weren't just going to be given rubbish, then they become appreciative, and then you start to have that sense of commonality. You know, the point about the Evening Standard is I really did walk out to the office, and there's my paper. And so you felt that this is our city, and therefore you take on a more role as stakeholder, perhaps rather than Fourth Estate. So I think that was a slight difference, that it was a great, you know, I was there when it was so sort of became so prosperous, when the skyline completely changed, also a city of tremendous inequality and poverty. And so I thought the sort of great thing that was done through the campaigning, and actually Evgeny Lebedev was very supportive of all this, was the campaigns, and that was basically saying, actually, back to when we were talking about the role of government. Saying,
we've had David Cohen on the podcast. He's a fantastic guy.
So
he is.
Yeah, so he's
lovely man,
and he absolutely sort of under. He's a man of such integrity, such a great journalist.
Disgusting amounts of integrity, frankly.
I know. but the idea, so you have Canary Wharf, you know, that absolute sort of symbol and center for money, and then next to it, you know, some places of tremendous poverty. Can we not kind of link it up, you know, because no one wants social apartheid. That's not how London was built. It makes people unhappy and uncomfortable, and it's led to a lot of the problems. So we just have to be neighbourly. And I think that was the sort of basis of what created a kind of goodwill towards the city, towards each other, and towards the newspaper.
Yeah, because it doesn't have to just only champion London externally. It has to champion London to London as itself.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. You know, that you have to, and there was a slight sense, I think before, someone described it as being a paper that you would sort of read outside London, you know, maybe in the suburbs, in a kind of dread, thinking, oh no, my daughter's there, you know,
and that they're London.
Yeah, exactly, and it's not safe, and so you have to, first of all, which is the true things that, you know, people can have a great, the opportunities here, people can have a great, they can find work, there's always somewhere open, the sense of sort of creative energy, you know, is remarkable. So allow people to have fun, and, you know, that was one thing I've always thought is, in journalism, you have to get out, you know, and find out what's going on. You know, it's no good just sitting and in this sort of tiny pool of news that we're all fishing in. Go out and find out what's going on. And, you know, you can do that in London. And certainly the young ones always looked completely exhausted, hardly dare ask what they've been up to. But it gave the paper a sense of life, you know, and energy and that they were part of this city. That was the point, you know, that you really had to understand. And actually on things, for instance, on gender fluidity was something, I think the Standard was writing about, you know, far before anyone else, because it had spotted it, because young people had said, you know, this is what it's like now. So those, you know, big social changes, you've got to be there at the beginning, I think, certainly for a paper like that.
So one of the things that fascinates me, though, about the differences between you being in the BBC now, where very famously you're not allowed any opinions or to have a view, you're very strictly impartial, is, you know, when you were editor of The Standard, you are allowed to have an opinion. You are allowed to back a particular candidate, for example. So when there's an election, you could choose Sadiq or Zach Goldsmith, and you picked Zach. How does that work then? Because, you know, Zach lost, so you then have to still champion the current mayor. Is it a bit like The King Is Dead, Long Live the King?
It was, you have to, the reasons for backing was an interesting one. So actually it was, you had to look at what the actual powers are for a mayor. And at the time we were quite focused on air quality. It was something that actually was one of those things that, because young people in the office had come in, you know, they were running or on bikes, and it, you know, it was hurt. You realised it was something really sort of urgent and tangible. And Zach was that, you know, that was his thing. He was the sort of green candidate. I think everyone agrees now it was a pretty terrible campaign, you know, and
on both sides, frankly.
Yeah. So it's I think the right candidate won, you know, so in that sense so it wasn't a sort of tremendously vigorous campaign against Sadiq. It was, and at the end, you know, we did say in the final leader, Sadiq is, you know, will be a good candidate and he has some great advantages. We really think air quality matters, so that's why we're going for that one. So I think, you know, these things are done in discussion with the proprietor and for reasons that, as long as you can sort of argue them cogently. But actually, I saw a lot of Sadiq after that, and did think he was very, very impressive. So I think there wasn't any bad blood over it.
He's strictly business at the end of the day. He's a professional politician.
Exactly.
And he knows that he's just won the election.
He's won the election, and that, you know, we need to work together. So
I mean, I'm glad Sadiq won. I'm a Labour Party member, but I wouldn't have been upset if Zach would have won either. He's not evil.
No.
He would have made a reasonably competent mayor. I think, you know, where people are quite realistic about the strengths and weaknesses of politicians.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been a terrible mayor.
He would have, I think, interesting, looking back, I think he's thoughtful. He had some really good ideas and he knew what he wanted to do. So I think he would have been impressive in that way. I think what he wouldn't have done, which actually is a really big part of being a mayor, and Boris did very well, and Sadiq does brilliantly, is the being out there. You know, actually, in a way, I don't know why Zach would, you know, he's shy, he's quite reserved, and he's quite private, you know, so that's no good. Whereas
the opposite of Boris,
The opposite of Boris, and Sadiq has this absolute sort of empathy, and actually you saw at the end, you know, just him out in the crowd, the effect that he has. So that sense of being, you know, a mayor among people, and he's out there and he's sort of championing you, and he's on Instagram and so on. That's, you know, I think that is very much part of being the role. So I think in that way, Zach would really have been terrible, actually. So I think the right person won, you know, in the end. But I think that I think what was unfortunate for Zach was that, as you say, he came with some really good ideas. And he, you know, he has had a pretty sort of honourable career. He's a man of principle, but somehow, you know, was the campaign in the end became known as a sort of, you know, racist, unpleasant campaign. So I think he must regret that very much, you know. And it shows that, you know, Londoners respond in a way that they don't like that, you know. So it was an interesting result.
I think mayors are held to different standards as well. Like Sadiq Rightly is held to a high standard, but mm-hmm. Boris had that Teflon-esque
yes, he did.
Element, which you almost, because it was Boris, you just forgave him. I remember I was at City Hall once a few years ago when he was mayor, and I was at a reception, and a light fell from the ceiling and smashed on the ground, and he was speaking at the time, and he said, "Oh, it's a good job no one was standing underneath that, because if they did, they would have deserved to have died. You know, I think that health and safety is ridiculous, and if you're stupid enough to stand under a heavy light, you deserve death." And everyone laughed, and there was all journalists in the room. No one reported it because everyone thought, oh, that's just Boris having a laugh, really. But then you see it when it comes to like Donald Trump at the moment, where he seems to be poisoning the well of journalism itself, where in a much more malevolent way. I mean, clearly Boris was just being jovial then, but Trump seems to be turning people off trust in journalists themselves. Does that concern you?
Well, it's an odd thing, the Trump effect, because in some ways he is trying to upturn everything and upturn, you know, what's true and what's not and so on. On the other hand, he has been brilliant for newspapers and for media. Actually, the figures for the Today programme, I noticed during that period when, you know, were record.
The so-called so Trump I
think
bump.
There was the Trump bump. So I think that in a way, sort of, we all benefit, you know, because people then, there's a sort of flight to trust, quality and trust, you know. So if you don't believe what someone's saying, and you know, and it is extraordinary. I remember someone who used to work at the White House and saying how she had journalists, she was a press officer, and she said journalists had phoned her saying, you know, we hear so-and-so is going to get sacked or whatever. And she said, no, that's absolutely not true. I've just been in the meeting. I know it's not true. And they would just laugh and go, and yeah, but my source is Donald Trump, you know. So it's a sort of, so it's an impossible job, you know, very difficult place to work, I would think. But I think it does, people do appreciate, as I say, that sort of trust and authority. So I think actually the media's benefited, mainstream media has benefited.
So in the last few questions, if I can I ask you about your career generally? When you started out, did you always want to be a journalist?
I don't think I did. I think I wanted to work in publishing, as I remember. And I think it just happened that... So I hadn't realised it was just something I could do. And I think it just comes down to a sort of curiosity and a sense of where the action might be. It's a sense of what might make a story, you know. So it's a sort of very simple thing. No great gift or, you know, you don't need great exams.
A sense of nosiness, one of their interviewees said. They said, I'm nosy. That makes me a great journalist.
I think so. You want to know what's going on and be very interested in people who know things, you know. So actually, which has been the wonderful thing, I guess, you know, during my lifetime, of the internet, the first-hand testimonies, you know, before something would happen, and it would take a while for you to get there, you know. Now, you know, the journalism is everywhere, and so then it's just a matter of sifting and curating it and professionalizing it. But the sense of, do you want to find out what's going on in the world? You know, there's never been a better time to be a journalist.
What's the most...
In that anyone can do it.
Well, I'm not sure of that. Yeah. That's very kind. What's been the most interesting and most memorable story you've ever worked on in your whole career? Is there something that even now, a decade or two later, you still remember and that still resonates?
I suppose I was in New York for September the 11th. And so I guess in terms of...
So you were actually in Manhattan?
Yes.
Wow.
So the sense of the significance of an event, and actually, you know, still remembering that time of people thinking someone said it's Pearl Harbor, you know, and you're thinking, kind of, is it, can I get? And the funny thing is, so you see something that's so important, that's so sort of apocalyptic, and actually you're what you're thinking of is entirely pragmatic things of, how can I get a phone? How can I get, you know, it was the phones going down was the difficult thing. So it's basically, it's how can I file? But I guess in terms of big stories, that was the biggest. The other, you know, just, I suppose the death of Princess Diana, you know, those sort of events of just what were the landmarks of journalistic sort of landmarks as well. I mean, historic, actually, what was history? What history did you witness, I guess?
And what kind of qualities do you need to get ahead to become editor of the Today Programme? Is it a sense of ambition? Is it graft? Is there, I asked someone once what the secret was, and he said the secret is there's no secret. You just have to know that. It's just hard work and curiosity.
Really hard work. I cannot tell you how hard work it is for this team. And so the first thing is the persuasion and a sense of absolutely bloody determination, you know, so that you have to get the story, you have to get the person, you have to persuade the person to come on, you have to make it work, you know. So that's what you see each day, you know, in the sort of absolute triumph if you fix something. So sort of sense of determination, a sense of interest in what's happening in the world. So again, being able to sort of spot what are going to be the most important things, not now, tomorrow, you know, so that what's going to set the agenda. And I guess for an editor, of having a sort of overall sense of, back to your point about the football matcher, of the players on the pitch. So you've got all the component parts. So, you know, I think, have we covered everything, and have we covered it with the right balance? Have we covered it, you know, impartially? Was it the best we could be? But that it needs to be complete, you know. So that's the thing, that each program I feel needs to be complete. And so there are days where you just think it just wasn't quite satisfactory. And then other days you kind of think, yeah, that was it. That program just had everything, and had, you know, an 8-10 that was, you know, that was really important and carries, and it had enough of a different textures, and it had, you know, humanity, and it had politics, and, you know, so it's creating a complete world each day that will set the agenda.
Sarah, it's been a hugely enjoyable interview.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.